Welcome to another podcast from Amana. Amana, once again, is a collective of people, places, things, and actions that transcend us. We're exploring people's virtues, higher values, what leads you to those to live by them, and what takes you off course and what brings you back on. And of course, it is a great pleasure today to introduce my father, John Harradine. Hello, Dad. Say hello.
G'day, Mark. How are you?
I'm good. I'm in Ojai, California, and you're in
Burleigh Heads.
Burleigh Heads. That's strange for me to say.
You probably were going to say Sydney because I've only just moved up here.
No, I know you've moved. I just haven't got to see it yet due to COVID. So
yeah,
I trust you're enjoying your new environment.
I love it up here. It's paradise, actually. Mm.
We're fortunate.
Yes, very fortunate.
So who knows where this podcast is going to go or lead us to, but let's start off by I'll ask you some of what in either your personal or professional life, and you can choose wherever you care to start, and maybe in many modes there they integrate, but what are some of your virtues or values that you would say that you live by, and what holds you in place and with them?
Well, just before we start, I had a pre-thought about a man called Steve Ferrix, who was our mentor, and he used to call us the Harradine brothers.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering what it's like going to be like for you to interview yourself. And how mirrors work in this life. Anyway,
we're blessed to have Steve in our life. I just celebrated his birthday 2 days ago, although he's been now gone for 9 years. And he certainly was a true friend of our family, to say the least.
Well, we called him the Godfather, if you recall.
I do.
Yeah. Well, the question was
what your values, either higher virtues or values, and you can just choose one, maybe two, that play out in your life that lead you in your life, really, either professionally or personally, and how do they lead you, and how do you align with it, and what takes you off that, and how do you get back into it when you do?
Well, I'll start with just one, and the one that comes to me is the word generosity. Of course, whenever we decide we're going to move towards something, everything comes along the challenges. And people tell me I'm a generous person, and I believe that I am. But what does that mean? It's not generous in terms of giving people money or that sort of thing. It's more about having a generosity of spirit, I think, towards people and towards the world. And it's a hard world sometimes to have a generosity of spirit with. But nonetheless, it's something that I keep gravitating towards as best I can. I think of the analogy of a jet airplane, and when it's on automatic pilot, it's 99% of the time off course. And so when we claim something like that, I think we've got to be vigilant around how we keep to our word around it. Now, if I get upset or angry with something or someone, that's not particularly generous. But how do I become generous in moving through that? Perhaps forgiveness might be required, or understanding. So there's other attributes that come along that kind of start hooking in to that one word. That might be a place to start. At least those are my initial thoughts.
And so, do you have a memory or a thought of when generosity, you first recognized generosity in your life, or was it from someone else? Were you aware of it in yourself? How did that come about?
My goodness me, the first thing that comes to me is my grandmother.
Yeah.
Your great-grandmother. Somehow she had this capacity to just keep loving people. Didn't mean she had judgments either, but it didn't. I just, probably the only experience I've ever really had in my early years anyway, of absolute unconditional love. And her generosity with me and how she took care of me, what she did with me. She lived down the street from me, so she was kind of like a third parent. And she was just always there. Her time she made available to me. She made sure I was safe. She started me playing tennis at 9. She just actually did everything for me. She told me I was her favorite grandson. I was actually her only grandson. And I wasn't probably the easiest kid in the world to be around. But that's where I think it really started.
Yeah. And so that would be a personal one. And you know, in terms of when you do get off track with that, or you're getting constriction, or I heard you say forgiveness is one of the processes that you use. How do you use forgiveness if you're in, I would imagine what takes you off, like most of us, is judgment.
Well, yeah, well, I think judgments always show up for us, but it's how you move through them quickly that's the issue. You know, we're judging machines in a way. But how do you move through them? I mean, they hold you hostage.
Right.
Forgiving the judgments on myself and others, I mightn't be able to forgive all the behaviour. I think it's better if I can. But I've had some pretty tough things happen in my life, and I believe I've been able to forgive the behaviour as I see it as a manifestation of the person's humanity. You know, if someone's, I see on the news, there's so much what I call persecutor victim behaviour in the news. But the humanity of those people, there's something underneath that that has been hurt. There's something underneath that that's been pained that people can't come to terms with. And they start stacking stuff on top of it to protect themselves. And if people knew better, they would do better. We all do the best with what we have and what we know. If we knew better, we would do better. And I mean knew better at an unconscious level.
Yeah.
Not just at a behavioural level, but there are parts of our unconscious that are completely out of our awareness, and we start doing the work on ourselves and embracing all of that, embracing our whole selves, not just our behaviour and thoughts and emotions and feelings, but our beliefs and values and our needs and fears. And when we kind of have a handle around what they are and have unpacked it all, we can start looking at the essence of who we're trying to be. But unless we do that, it keeps creeping in and trapping us in old patterns. I'm not sure if that's answering your question, but
no, I think it gives explanation to, you know, how these things, as you said, pile on or come at us, and mm-hmm. you know, how do we get them off? Perhaps yeah. Let's go to a place, and I, in your professional career, maybe give us a little bit of a background on your professional career. And as I'm even asking you the question, I'm thinking about how, you know, and we'll get to this too, as you're a psychiatrist, a psychotherapist now, but really how your professional career has been somewhat very symbiotic, I think, of self-discovery.
Yes,
around self, that. Around the world, around people, society. So maybe give us a background and some of your education that you've explored to come to where you are now.
Well, as you know, my teenage life was pretty troublesome. And my parents were very deeply connected to each other, but they were also very dysfunctional with it. And I just thought there's got to be another way. In the way that love was handled. And I ended up, my first real career was in the human resources field. And so as I kind of moved along that field, there's two people that come to mind, actually. One was, can I actually use a person's name on the podcast?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. The first person's name was a fellow called Bob Biggs. And I worked for a company called Computer Accounting Services. They were kind of like an EDS Australian version of it, not as big. And he was very supportive of me setting up the HR function with their organisation. And he just believed in me. And I was with them for about 7 or 8 years before they got taken over. In fact, when I look at my career, I think it's been a product of many companies that got taken over. Mm. But he just supported me to set up the HR function in that organisation when the CEO didn't want it. And I had a 12-month trial, basically. I didn't know it. But it worked out. And he just kept encouraging me to go for it. And so that's the first instance I remember in my career of that kind of generosity and support. And the second person is a person called Kevin Wallace. Kevin was the HR director for Digital Equipment that not many people would have heard of today. It was a company in my time in the 80s and 90s of 125,000 people. And there were some 2,000 to 3,000 in Australia and New Zealand. And he was the HR director for that company. And initially, apparently, I called into another very close friend, also very generous, who was running the hiring process, a woman called Marilyn Smith, both of whom become very close friends today, kept persevering with me with this application. And I was approached for it initially. But Kevin wasn't sure whether I was the right person or not. But I did an interview with him, and he asked me, when do you break the rules? And I thought, that's an interesting question. And I sat there maybe for 10 or 15 seconds, but it felt like about 30 to a minute. And I, when the consequences of keeping them are graver than the consequences of breaking them, and it got me the job.
Hmm.
And from that time on, he was nothing but supportive of me on every level, personally, professionally. We did some great work together. We changed a system that across the world, actually, not for the betterment as it turned out in the end, with the introduction of certain things. But and we had a worldwide reputation for the work that we did, and it was his support that kept me going through those years. I was with them for 10 years, and I'd have to say it was a halcyon period of my career across so many different levels. It was probably also one of the most challenging personal periods of my life, because I was 38 when I joined them, and there till I was about 47, 48 years of age, or maybe 36, 37 I was, till about 46, 47 years of age. And so that was a period of my life that was very challenging, to be generous with myself. That was very hard. But he was just there and still is. I know you've had a few conversations with him. He's just one of these people that will, once you're with him, you're with him. And he's a stayer. I've got a deep fondness for him.
Just to tap into that time period too, and I think we've all seen this change in society, but I think, and that was very much, although you're in Australia, it was very much what may be branded as corporate America, you know, certainly the corporate life, although there's some cultural differences.
It was the second largest computer company in the world.
Yeah, that stemmed out of Boston. So it kind of came from those, you know, the American corporate culture. And I'm just curious what some of the values that you saw then that were in the culture that maybe you don't see today that could be revisited or that were at least helpful to that time in your work.
Well, digital was established in the 60s and 70s by a guy called Ken Olson, and he was a Quaker. And the byline of the business publicly was do the right thing.
Mm.
It was one of the first what they call matrix structures in the world. A matrix structure is where you have more than one boss and it requires an enormous amount of cooperation. And the culture was you're going to be working with somebody. Look, why don't you two work with each other on this? and so and so and so and so going to work with each other on that. That word was common throughout the entire organization. It was political, but not malevolently so.
Mm-hmm.
And cooperation was one of the core was probably the core value, and it worked. I had five bosses.
Wow.
I had Kevin here in Australia, but I also determined pay, goals, performance criteria for my CEO, and also policies, who I reported to about the executive team's salary levels and how I, in those early years, back in the late 80s, and I was accountable to him for the whole executive team's salary packaging. I had a functional boss in the US who looked after what was called the comp and benefits function, which was a lot broader than what the name implies, but it was a very strategic function. It was not just number crunching. And then Kevin's boss was also my boss, the HR director in Boston.
Hmm.
And so I had to work out how to manage upwards.
Yes.
Because they had their differences. And it was one of the most informative times of my life and really helped me understand how to manage differences and conflict. And I think that's also been a big part of my life, conflict and differences on so many levels, inwardly and externally. But learning to manage that upwards was just one of the best lessons I think I've ever been taught, and really appreciate people for who they are, looking underneath what they're presenting, and for more than that. And somehow I was regarded as probably, along with another guy in Canada, the two most successful people in the world at it, a guy called Gary Arbuthnot, who's not with us anymore, but he was a bit of a mentor for me when I first started. And people just connected with each other in ways I've not seen. And in fact, when digital went through its bad times, it retrenched 65,000 people in 5 years. It missed the PC market. There are a whole lot of reasons for that.
Mm.
They wrote a book called Deck is Dead, Long Live Deck. Digital Equipment Corporation was short for Deck. And the guy who wrote it was also my functional boss when I started doing organizational transformation work. A fellow called Ed Schein, he wrote this book. An amazing man. And he was a chief advisor to Ken Olson directly. And it was about people who got retrenched and kept trying to recreate digital in other organizations they'd gone to, and expressions of frustration at how politically, malevolently politically, these organizations were compared to digital. Now, people weren't perfect, don't misunderstand me. There was manipulation that certainly went on, but not to harm or hurt each other. More about getting some of your own needs met or a division's needs met. But efforts were made not to have that at the expense of others.
Mm.
And I don't know, I've never worked for another organisation before or since, or as you know, I consulted for 20-odd years.
Yeah.
Or nor seen another organisation that came anywhere near close to that kind of culture. I made a lot of friends there. And then more recently, Eileen DeGuria, my functional boss in the C&B area, I reconnected with her, and it was just such a lovely thing to do. And I went over to Boston a couple of years ago. We weren't able to meet up, but we attempted to. She was out of town. So lots of really good friendships were made in that organisation. I've got personal friends today, and one of my closest friends is, you know, Terry, if not my closest friend. It's where I met her.
Yeah, I just as a child, I just remember you going off to work every day in the perfect car and the perfect suit and the perfect colors and the perfect hair. And I thought it must be great when you get to go to work, you know, because I hated school. But I also knew I had a deeper sense, I think, even as a kid, that you, although there may be turmoil inside of you, that you're in a happy place. You know, with good people, and I got to meet all those people. They became mentors and friends of mine. You know, so I, and as much as I said as a young child, I never want to do what my dad did, basically, because I just didn't know what you did. I think it was just above me. But at a certain juncture, our paths crossed, and here we are, and I do on many levels similar work. You know, and you've taught me so much through a lot of the consulting models and things that you've learned on your journey. I'm so grateful for it. Maybe tap into some of the consulting tools that you, not such a deep dive, because you are the walking workshop, as I used to call you, of so many models. But these models are brilliant, and I've learned how to use some of them to help people build business and build association and understanding of what's going on, how to build vision and culture and align goals and build healthy environments. So maybe just share some of the top level tools that you've had access to and then worked.
Yeah, I think I have been an avid explorer of mechanisms to create positive change. I don't think there's many things that I'm not touched into because of my personal need, basically, to integrate myself and ensure that I'm feeling whole in life. And the essence of the tools that I've used has been to open up the consciousness of people. And I think the three things that come to mind initially are spiral dynamics, which not a lot of people have heard of, more so have. But I first came across it when I did my master's degree in social ecology and in applied science in social ecology. And this structure was used to free South Africa by Nelson Mandela. And I was lucky enough to have a scholar in residence in that program who had been on Nelson Mandela's negotiating team, white South African Jewess. I think Jewess is still an okay term. I'm not sure quite how to describe that. But she was amazing. And I just saw the depth of how Claire Graves, who originally did all the research back in the 70s alongside people like Maslow, unpacked the value systems of various cultures and could see that the value systems emanated from the life conditions that surrounded the environment. So if you were in survival, then the value system was going to apply to that. If you were in a sense of opulence and financial success, the value system was going to provide that. If you were in an environment that really cared deeply around each other and people, your value system was built around that. And what he discovered was there are basically eight layers, and the ninth one is still evolving. And it's called spiral dynamics because you spiral up. But it's not superior inferior spiraling up. It's just a set of values that applies to a system. And as the system gets more effective or wider in some certain aspects, the value system starts to shift. And if you look at what's happening today, we're actually regressing. Because the value system's changing back towards survival, particularly with COVID-19. People start to regress unless their consciousness has lifted to such a point where they can hold it. And there's a whole lot of theories built into that value system I could go into for the whole session, so I won't do that. But well, I think the underlying piece of that is that value systems are determined by the life conditions that surround us. That's the first one. Yes, you were going to say something, Mark.
Yeah, I was just going to say you introduced me to spiral dynamics and it did take me a while to kind of catch it. But once I did, I would consider it's the second most powerful model that I've ever come across. Soul transcendence would be the first one.
Yeah.
It helped me.
Soul transcendence model is what they call the turquoise level of spiral dynamics, because spiral dynamics includes soul transcendence, not in quite the way you're describing it, but it's the highest vibration in the spiral dynamics framework. So they're not mutually exclusive. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No. I concur with you. I totally agree. And what it did for me was it helped me ground and understand and ask questions for you know, I just did a podcast recently with someone who's traveled a lot through all different kind of cultures, and it's helped me help them build understanding around different value systems, all the different microcultures, you know, if we took Asia or the United States or any continent really, there's so many levels of consciousness in all these different societies, and how do we come together or how do we break apart, but really how do we align? It doesn't mean we need to be the same. And my layman terms of explaining it is it's like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, although Maslow's hierarchy of needs is more probably geared towards the individual, where Graves and Mean Codes is more towards society bands, you know, bands of society, hence memes.
I think Graves is Maslow on steroids.
Oh, absolutely. No doubt about it. And I much prefer it. There's such more exploration in it. But it's just been a powerful tool that I can use in business or even government conversations, you know, and with people in society. So I'm very grateful that you've shared Spiral Dynamics with me, and it helps me build values for people in the places where I serve. Well, and what would be another one there?
Well, there's two others that I think probably cover just about everything else. Robert Keegan's levels of thinking is more like it's more directed towards the individual level, but it's certainly got some real parallels to Spiral Dynamics, where his research out of Harvard showed that 16% of adults don't make it past egocentric thinking, which is it's all about me. Another 60% don't make it past, or 59% don't make it past socialized thinking, which is what do you think about me? So 75% of our population, and I suggest possibly even more, are operating off it's all about me and what do you think about me? And hence you get this kind of, in fact, reality TV is making a fortune out of that level of thinking. Then he talks about independent thinking, which is I'm true to my beliefs. I respect yours, but I'm kind of not aligned with them, so I wish you well. No judgment. And in organisations, they're called cultural creatives, and they're often the first people on the retrenchment list because they disturb the status quo. They're the change agents. And then there's what's called integral thinking, which is I'm true to my beliefs, I respect yours, and what could we do better together that we wouldn't be able to do as well singularly? And that is only 1% of the population are operating there. And then there's sacred thinking, which is more like that transcendent thing you're thinking about, where 0.1% of the population live. We have all these levels, but there's a center of gravity that we hold into. And we go up and down, and you don't lose egocentric, socialized, independent, integral at sacred. You know, Nelson Mandela was sacred, but he also had egocentric in him. He blew up power stations. That sacred thinking is all about what can we do for future generations. And as a center of gravity, I don't know if this research is quite a bit old, so it may have changed, but we're not in that place certainly now. And if you think about how the world is functioning, there's a lot of humanitarianism coming through and care coming through because of this disease. It's waking that mimetic system up. But it's also in battle with the idea of how do we keep the economy open, which is all about self-interest.
Right.
And so you have these global battles, but we also have them individually, and that's what Keegan's work was about. And the other one is Ken Wilber's work on integral thinking, he wrote a book called A Brief History of Everything, and he narrowed it down to four things: what we do together, what I do to contribute to what we do together, who are we together, and who am I in this? And I think that's a really holistic model that can apply to an individual and a group and a country, any system that you're in, which is what I've used in strategy and leadership work. Where are you on any of those things? What are the blockers and enablers in each of those four quadrants? But most of the time, people are spending 95% of their time in the we do and I do area. They might analyze where who we are, but it's basically an academic diagnostic exercise they don't know what to do with because the level of consciousness isn't there to do something with it.
Mm.
So those three probably would be the overarching things I've learned about that I think you can use at a micro and a macro level. There's certainly, like psychometric instruments, there's a whole lot of individual things you can do, team things that you can do. But in the end, it's unpacking what's the consciousness of this entity that we're dealing with, whether it's an individual, a group, a section of an organization, a whole organization, a city, a country, the world.
Yes. You know, they're powerful tools. They've certainly, I use them currently with clients and for myself, and it's certainly deepened my understanding. Is there, not for all of them, but maybe there's one, maybe you've hibernated it, but is there one where you could give an example where you've gone into a company, you can name the company or not name the company, where you've used some of these tools and it's had a really profound impact?
It's a few, but I'm trying to think of one that might have. Where's the biggest impact thing? Yeah, I think there was a major food supplier in this country. They made bread. And the elasticity of bread pricing is very tight, very hard to make money in it. Mm-hmm. You move a loaf of bread by a cent, and your profitability can go down by exponential percentages. And I worked, it was a particular structure in that business that they were a problem with, which was the pricing structure. It was fundamental to their success. And we took the sales director, his direct reports, and a diagonal slice right down to the truck driver. There were 20 people over a period of 8 months. And the outcome was we added $17 million to the bottom line and an expansion in their marketing penetration. And it was one glaring example using some of these concepts as we started teaching these concepts, and we did a thing called top mapping where we mapped the processes using islands and animals and houses and buildings to symbolically represent who was what. And roads, crooked roads represented bad communication lines, straight roads were for straight communication lines. And we did what was a current perception. And we had other symbols like swamps and crocodiles. This current perception was loaded with swamps and crocodiles, and we were talking about the levels of consciousness they were at and how they were thinking about it and what the frustrations were as we went through it. And we had five teams of four people with a diagonal slice across all the functions of the organization, right down to the truck driver. And it was a layered process to get to what we called a consolidated vision map across 20 people. And I remember the final discussion about the vision map. And they were talking about it. They were all lined up. We were using some of these concepts to help them understand their differences. And they thought they got the map locked away. And then a truck driver spoke up. Now, typically what would happen is the truck driver wouldn't even think to speak up in a situation like that.
Mm-hmm.
At least in this country, and everyone's going, yes, 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 yes. And he goes, what about, and instead of them shutting him down, they won't tell us about it, and he put another $3 million on the line because they listened to him. And it was about digging into their consciousness of understanding and acceptance using these frameworks that caused that result. There's a few others, but that's probably the most outstanding one. One of the most outstanding ones I can recall. And we did a conference afterwards with the top 100. We did a roadshow around the map around and did the same thing with all the people that we took. This was a company of about 5,000 people, so it wasn't small. By international standards, small, but certainly not a small business. And they were a conglomerate of bakers that had been small shops that have been gradually pooled together into this huge organisation. But they had such pride, Mark, in their work and the product that they were making. And it was making bread's a very perfected thing. Yes, and what was curious around that, it wasn't until about three quarters of the way through, I had real kind of connection with them as a group of people. And I didn't realise it until later that my great-grandfather was a baker.
Mm.
And my grandmother used to talk about him with such love and his generosity. They were in Kentish Town in London. They had a five-storey terraced house. They weren't wealthy, but, you know, and after Nan died, I went and found that house and walked up the stairs in the house. That was an amazing experience. But she used to talk about how generous he was. Now, that's just a connection I've not really made before around that word generosity. Mm. He would make Christmas cakes for everybody in the street at Christmas time and literally go to their houses and deliver it to them. That's something I haven't thought about for years.
Mm.
And what's interesting about this conversation is when you have the kind of conversation we're talking about right now, something like this surfaces when you're open-hearted about certain things that have happened in your life.
Yes.
You start to make these connections.
Yeah.
Right? And connection leads to generosity. It's separation that leads to the opposite of it, which is contraction. And, you know, that connection was, I made that connection a long time ago, but I haven't thought about it for years. And so when you think about these things, your consciousness is open at the unconscious levels. Things bubble up like that. And it's a very connecting experience. And it's about recognizing the generosity in other people to recognize it in yourself. And it was my great-grandfather that she used to talk about was so generous. And so did my mother. It was my paternal grandfather, but my mother talked about him that way too. What a beautiful soul he was. I never met him, of course.
Mm.
But that got into the heritage, I think, somehow. I don't know if I'm off track, but it just personal connection.
Well, I think it's a great example because a lot of what these models can dive us into is these associations, and that's where power really comes from because we connect through association and experience, and that's what drives most people's motives in my observation. Is when you have positive association, caring association is when you really can move something. Funnily enough, one of my last clients was a patisserie, so I just learned all about bread making and vinoiserie and was interviewing bakers every day. So here we are with all these associations. I would like to go to another place here, and that's more to your current work, which is that of a psychotherapist. To me, you're in a space, and this is from afar, of course, but where you get to use so many of these tools, because I know you still do some business consulting, and I bring you in to help me with design and what companies are doing. So maybe speak a little bit about that. Your practice these days and what your values are and your virtues around your current practice and some of the things that you've discovered or exploring.
As you're asking that question, and the one before that you're asking me, there was another example, if I could give you a quick example.
Sure.
Because it links to what you've just asked me. There was another organisation we helped set up in Australia, which is second largest telco in the country. And we wanted to walk away from them because they were just completely the antithesis of all we've been talking about. And we went through a process with our leadership and they let us withdraw. And we said, no, we're not going to do this. But 6 to 9 months later, they asked us back. And the reason I'm telling that story is that sometimes you've got to learn to say no to get to do this work.
Mm.
And when they asked us back, we worked with them for 18 months. They were a new startup at the time back in 1991, and now they're the second largest telco in this country. And they've also got links overseas. And we worked with them for 18 months and we launched three major product lines on time, on budget, with such enthusiasm and connection, dealing with all the conflicts. Because we'd said no when we went back, we said, we'll say yes on the basis that if you are going to look into these deeper layers of what's holding you back. Otherwise, we've seen this as a waste of time for you. And they said yes. So the purpose of me sharing that, that's where I learned to say there's a time when you say no to something, that something's not right for you.
Mm.
And that's not being generous, anything but. It's not about saying no with judgment. It's saying, no, this won't work. And in my work today, it's been one of the value lessons, the most valuable lessons that I've had in dealing with my clients. You know, I have people come with varying and many issues and problems. A lot of my clientele are people still in the business world. Perhaps because of my background, or I attract some of that.
Can you just define your practice a little bit so we can give context?
Yeah, well, I'm a psychotherapist and counsellor.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I work with families. I work with family businesses. I work with relationships and couples. I work with individuals. I use a multitude of modalities. I subsequently, when I first set this up, I'd done a lot of organisational psych research and things of that nature, but I'd never done what you'd call clinical psychology stuff. So I went and did an undergraduate degree in clinical psychology. To get the essence of how that functions relative to the organisational world, I didn't learn too many tools I could use, but I think it certainly showed me some underlying theories and where they come from, some of which I still have some questions about, but that's okay too. And so I transitioned across out of the corporate world. And during that corporate time, I wrote a lot of articles for lawyers. And that ended up, and then I adjusted those articles for individuals, you know, with not that kind of organizational or corporate flavor. And then I turned it into my book called Breaking Patterns.
Mm.
And that's been my, and then when I realized after I'd written those articles, it was actually a process compositing just about all the theories I'd ever learned about, including some of the clinical theories, in terms of not the theories just presenting them, but in terms of the philosophy in the book is underpinned by what I've learned, what I buy into, what I challenge. So when I'm working with individuals, I'm very client-focused. I've got a lot I can draw on to be client-focused. I'm not throwing some methodology at them. I'm looking for who they are in their consciousness and what that is about for them, using those frameworks that are in the back of my head.
Have you found a commonality with your clients? Let's go back to our values or virtues that you think that people are looking for, or maybe at this time discovering, recognizing that you have a vast array of clients, you know, from all different walks of life. I would imagine there's some commonality of value system somewhere in there. I'm interested.
Yeah, they're looking for emotional. They're looking for emotional safety, Mark.
Mm.
Everyone's looking for emotional safety, even if they don't know it.
What does that mean?
That they feel safe with another person and they feel safe with themselves, that there's a sense of self-trust about their choices. I don't think they realise that when they're walking through the door. They're typically trying to solve a problem, like a dynamic problem that they call, we've got communication problems. Yeah. But they're not really looking at what's underneath those communication issues. And so that's the thing I feel has come through with everybody I talk to. How am I emotionally safe in the world? Now, it's not the emotional bravado safety, you know, particularly that macho emotional safety, where I can defend and fend off anything I can. I won't mention any names, but he happened to lead your country for a while that you're in. There's no emotional safety in that, but there's a pretense and imposter's version of it by constantly making others wrong, That's not emotional safety. Being on top, that's not emotional safety. Being able to embrace your vulnerability and stand beside it and not collapse into it, but embrace it. That's where emotional safety lives. And when two people can do that together, something sparks. You know, it just kind of surfaces when you feel safe with someone else in your life. I had that with Kevin, Marilyn, you know, this guy, Bob Biggs, many others, yourself, of course, and Christopher, with your mum, a lot of that.
I would imagine a commonality around that, though. People who take this path of, let's call it self-discovery, we all get there. I don't say we all get there, but I think a lot of us who do get there to do the inner work, to look at oneself, you've got to have a great amount of courage, because it does take that vulnerability to take a dive into yourself, which can eradicate some of that emotional false stability.
Yeah. And I don't think it's bravado courage. I think it's simple willingness.
Yeah.
And that's the courageous, to look in the mirror and look at yourself and say, who am I? Not what do I do? Not what is my role? I'm a father, I'm a worker, I'm a professional, I'm a tradesman, I'm a husband, I'm a wife. No. But who am I in all of that? And along the road, when I look at who I've been, there were parts of me that weren't present that needed to be, as you well know. But unless you actually face all those vulnerabilities inside of you, you're constantly on the defensive. Or in judgment, you're either on the defensive, which is driven by fear, or you're in contempt, which is driven by judgment. And those two things you kind of vacillate between, unless you kind of know yourself. And you've got to look at that within yourself, in my experience. No one has to do anything, really. But in terms of finding that higher vibration, whatever that is for you, that emotional safety, you've got to find it with yourself first. But people look outside first most of the time, and that's a false positive.
It is amazing how our lives, you know, take us in whatever direction, and the paths that present themselves or the opportunities that present themselves. And you know, me being your son, but I'll say this, it's like I recognize, although you're such a part of me, that your life has been highly conflicted at times, highly challenged, and look at the work that you do that is going into these conflicts, understanding it, unpacking it. And I think, you know, I come back to that value for you is great courage, you know, which is that of the heart, to step in and to go beyond what the mind or the emotions would dare safe, and to risk, but to know that there's something greater on the other side of the in the unknown.
I don't know if you ever know something's greater on the other side.
Well, I don't think, but I think there's a sense. Yeah, I think there's a trust. We must trust to leap, you know, otherwise we won't leap.
Someone once said two things create change: the pain's so great you can't stand it anymore, or the opportunity's so big you can't leave it alone, and most people are motivated by the former. And so if the pain's so great you can't stand it anymore, it requires willingness that requires courage, but you don't feel the courage in the moment. If anything, you probably feel fear. But that's the embracing of fear is the courage.
Yes.
I think about it, as you've asked me.
We're getting towards the end of time here, and I just wanted to, you know, bring that forward around the courage piece, because it just kind of showed up. And I just want to thank you for being a great dad my whole life and loving me, supporting me. You've encouraged me to risk. You've encouraged me to leap and follow my dreams. And I've been a big dreamer. And I've had a lot of my dreams be realized because of your encouragement. And just on a professional front too, I didn't ever want to do what you did, not knowing even know what it was, but you took me under your wing when I did live in Australia, and it was amazing within, I think it was two, let's just say a 2 to 3 year period. It was like I could absorb so much of those models and tools, probably because on some level I had been through them through all your life as almost a guinea pig.
Kind of lived it.
I kind of became the walking part of the experience. But it's put a tremendous blessing in my professional career of how to support people in business and governmental environments or structured environments or group environments where people need to come together in order to achieve something. I think our notion is always on the positive side of that. It's never been with malice or destruction or againstness towards anything else. So these things that you've taught me have helped me be on the up and up. And this, do you have any last, I'm going to put, just for our listeners, I'm going to be putting a lot of these models into the podcast notes. I'll put John's book, Breaking Patterns, in there so you can have access to find out more about that. It's a rich book. Maybe just touch on your book a little bit, John.
Well, there's two phrases that I use, one on the back, one on the front. The Breaking Patterns, a map to love, joy, and contentment. And on the back, there's a little explanation there. Run the life you want to have, a life runs you. So it's about a self-empowering experience and looking at all the things, as you said, that hold you back, that take you off course. And then moving, the first half of the book is about understanding all of that. The second half of the book is all about what you do to move forward. And there's exercises in it. There's a bit of biography in it at the end of each chapter about how my journey has been outlaid in, according to the principles in each chapter. And I always invite my clients to write their own little biography so they get to start to integrate who they are. So that's basically the essence of the book.
Yeah, so I'll give our listeners, you know, access to that link where they could go in and purchase it. It's on Amazon and to your website. Thank you very much for sharing today. I hope we get to do this again. I'm sure we will. Is there any parting words you would want to leave our listeners with?
I just want to thank you for inviting me to do it, and I feel so grateful that we can do this together. I feel you and Christopher, your brother, you and I have a connection as fathers and sons, or father and sons and brothers, that is really quite profound. It's not to say it's always been rosy, but we know how to find each other and we know how to be emotionally safe with each other, and that's something really special. And I thank you for being who you are and the way you do that, and Christopher for who he is and how he does that. You do it differently. But the connection is there. I do remember one night in a spa till 4 o'clock in the morning where we were talking about the Harradine family dynamics. I don't know too many fathers and sons that would do that. But it was a very exploratory and eye-opening experience for three of us, I think.
And intense.
Yes, it was. Well, intensity is probably one of the hallmarks of our relationship and family.
Yeah,
but which is often in a good way, but when there's some differences, they get intense too. But we always come out the other side, and that's what matters.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of love there, and I love you. And Christopher, I don't know, would I say more than my life? Probably. but certainly as much as my own life. And, so thanks for the opportunity. It's really nice to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, no, thank you. And I really look forward to, you know, when these things with COVID, I know as we're talking currently, a lot of Australia is on lockdown again, which kind of affects me in some way, because I would like to get back physically and see your new home and your new life in Queensland and Burleigh Heads and the beach and the wonderful life that you've so deserve at this time of your life, kind of a more, hopefully, at peace.
There's a lot of peace inside of me, and there's still a lot of pieces inside of me.
It's never ending, that's for sure.
I say, if we're a work in process, we're a work in progress. Mm-hmm. Or as the Americans would say, if we're a work in process, we're a work in progress.
All right. Well, thank you again. I love you. And
I love you too.
Stay tuned, listeners. There'll be more. And thanks for listening. And bye for now.
Thanks, man. Bye for now.